Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about more of the future for progressive politics in America and a little bit about many of the things affecting the international relationships and the movement for black lives and a UN report on racism in America. But before we can move on, the news stories out of Milwaukee now are all about how a sense of calm has been restored to the Sherman Park neighborhood where residents rebelled over the weekend. Milwaukee's Democratic Mayor Tom Barrett has instituted a 10 p.m. curfew aimed at area teens in an alleged effort to prevent more unrest. This shows exactly why the unrest happened in the first place. The biggest problem from the point of view of the authorities are teenage kids. The reason it happened is because their parents weren't forced to keep them inside. It shows how thinly veiled the real views of Milwaukee's elites truly are. Perhaps this can be better understood by contrasting two recent headlines in a major American news sources. Just in the aftermath of the uprising, the Wall Street Journal carried a piece with the title, quote, Milwaukee neighborhoods slid after factory jobs vanished. In that piece, they quote the head of the Sherman Park Community Association, Fred Curzon, noting the loss of the manufacturing base here has taken a big toll. That's a quote. The journal notes that the 2006 closing of the Tower Automotive Factory whisked thousands of jobs away, many that had belonged to area residents. They go on to note that 40% of black males between 25 and 44 are without work or jailed or disabled. Edward Staples, a neighborhood business owner, also noted the lack of any major commerce, even Walmart, which just recently closed, created a perception that there is, quote, no value here, that drove away other investments. The other important headline that came out around the same time earlier this week was in Politico, titled, quote, Obama takes trade battle to the heartland, talking about how he was traveling to areas hard hit by globalization to tout the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, trade deal. In so many ways, there's the problem in a nutshell. The conditions that have turned Milwaukee and other cities just like it into a tinderbox just ready to catch fire are birthed by the types of policies that political elites and their big money backers are trying to keep promoting. So here we are after Milwaukee, after Baltimore, after Ferguson, and yet the principal result in each one is all about restoring order, restoring calm, not restoring the ability of residents to build decent lives. The Movement for Black Lives has just released a policy platform that, in fact, speaks to all of those issues. One of the authors of that report, M. Adams, who was featured on this show, actually lives in Milwaukee. Mayor Tom Barrett has been consistent in calling for calm and scolding parents to keep their kids inside, but he hasn't said once that he was bringing in any of the local, or national for that matter, activists to have a serious discussion about solutions they are proposing. And Sheriff David Clark, who famously stated that blue lives matter while he declared his support for Trump at the Republican National Convention, has taken a page from his preferred candidate by building a fence around the actual Sherman Park that gives the neighborhood its name. And also, like Donald Trump, seems to fail to recognize that his wall is more of a sign that he has no idea what the problem is or how to solve it. The spotlight has partially fallen on the gentrification efforts around the city's downtown and their significant inadequacy, which truly should put a spotlight on the fact that in a large proportion of Democratic-controlled major metropolitan areas, words like, quote, community development and job creation are being used to create more vibrant zones for large businesses, upscale commerce, and luxury apartments, while the poorer residents are either pushed out of their neighborhoods or their neighborhoods are left to wither and die on the vine. Where are the calls from Tom Barrett and his police officials, or for that matter, the local politicians, for major national action on these issues? President Obama has often scolded activists for not actually having demands. Well, they have a ton now. And why isn't he stopping in Milwaukee to convene a conversation on them as he goes on his Heartland tour? Why? Because ultimately these people do not actually care. They want to move forward with the same type of global economy that privileges profit over people, with maybe just a few extra tweaks. And it's at the root of their problem with the police. They have pursued a military solution to a social problem. And now when they could change course, they don't want to move to replace that with the social and economic policies to turn the ship around. Shame on all our so-called leaders, especially the ones out calling for calm. In other police terror-related news, the family of Akai Gurley, killed by New York City police officer Peter Liang in 2014, will receive a financial settlement. The Gurley family is receiving just over $4 million, with the city paying the family $4.1 million and an additional $400,000 coming from the New York City Housing Authority and $25,000 from Mr. Liang himself. This, of course, is far from justice, and the Akai Gurley case has been frustratingly elusive. Officer Liang and his partner were engaged in the controversial practice of vertical patrols, where the police patrol the hallways of housing complexes, which are often poorly lit and maintained. Liang discharged his weapon, he claims by accident, into an unlit stairwell. A bullet glanced off a wall and hit Akai Gurley, who was 28, in the heart as he was walking down the stairs with his girlfriend. Liang, upon finding Gurley in a pool of blood with his girlfriend, did nothing to help resuscitate him. In fact, he left the building almost right away as Akai was left there to die, which, by the way, is against NYPD policy. Liang blamed poor training for failing to try to administer CPR or call for an ambulance. However, a jury didn't see it that way, and in a rare instance, convicted an officer. Liang was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter. A judge, however, decided that Liang should get the same treatment the vast majority of cops get, a pass for murder. He sentenced Liang to no jail time. In fact, he sentenced him only to probation and 800 hours of community service. And with this, it again means the largest burden for a police murder falls on the community through their tax dollars. While the money will partially go for a college fund and other costs for Mr. Gurley's daughter, Akila, it certainly won't bring him back to life. There is now a culture of blood money in police murder cases, where courts and administrative efforts do nothing from the standpoint of police accountability, but where city officials then offer large sums of money to the families of those slain in lieu of justice. In some cities like Baltimore, they even have non-disclosure-style clauses that prevent the family or living victims from disparaging the police to turn the blood money into equal parts hush money. This is what we've come to, where rather than justice for cop killings, victims are told they have to make do with a payoff. And finally, and staying with New York, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani reached a new level of untruthfulness this week with an absurd interview where he tried to pretend 9/11, which happened when he was the mayor, didn't really happen. In an interview where Giuliani was trying to make the case that Barack Obama has not kept the country safe as part of a broader defense of Donald Trump's law and order policies, Giuliani just fantastically, ridiculously stated there were no successful, quote, radical Islamic terrorist attacks on U.S. soil before Obama was elected. This is so ridiculous, in fact, that it is clearly a deliberate lie. Taking a page out of Trump's book and saying things regardless of veracity that will buttress the point. Not only does this ignore 9/11, but also the 1993 World Trade Center bombing that happened 1 year before Giuliani was mayor. It's not like Giuliani really forgot. It's that he is more than willing to hook himself to Trump's law and order wagon. And it's important to remember that the Trump phenomenon may be sui generis, but it isn't new. As mayor of New York, Giuliani had a reputation as the law and order guy. He turned the NYPD loose on the city and countenanced the brutal harassment of communities of color and the homeless. All of this, of course, was in service to a drive loved by the Fortune 500 companies and Wall Street execs to gentrify Manhattan for luxury offices and apartments, not to mention tourists. He also, of course, had a reputation for being at best tone deaf on racial issues and at worst, and probably most truly, an outright racist. The Republican Party has been filled with people willing to say and do outrageous things, not that far removed or exactly the same as Trump, depending on the issue. They just have not been willing to buck the 1% elites that have kept the populist rhetoric in check the same way Trump has. Trump is not an unprecedented evil, just an effective one. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are joined to continue this conversation with, as always, an excellent panel of guests in studio. We have Mr. Delvon Michaels of Working Families DC, and by phone, Abigail Collazo, Electoral Director for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, PCCC. Thank you both for joining the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
No, of course. So just starting from the top, one of the points that I think is interesting about Milwaukee, which everyone is talking to, as we keep hearing all this rhetoric, especially on the Democratic side of the ledger about rebuilding communities this year. It's an election year. We probably hear that every year. But then on the same token, we have President Obama going to push TPP in the quote unquote heartland, which, you know, Milwaukee, I guess, is in the heartland, which seems like sort of a cautionary tale, right? What's happened with Milwaukee because of free trade. So I wonder, and Delphine, I'll start with you. If you're someone who's now living on the north side of Milwaukee, where Sherman Park is located, where the uprising took place, and you've seen, you know, your standard of living just sort of slip away, slip through your fingers through a couple of generations. I mean, forget voting for Hillary Clinton. Almost why would you vote anyway when it seems like such a bait and switch and that the real issues aren't really fully being addressed?
I can totally see where you're coming from with the not voting thing. But, you know, democracy is a system that we're actually living in, a system that we're actually using right now for the current moment. And, you know, you've got to vote and be active. You're going to actually get something that addresses your problems. But that being said, the president's going to be welcomed with open arms and kisses and roses, and he should be excoriated when he comes there. Unfortunately, African-American people give him a pass. Like, he's not delivered, quite frankly, if you ask me. And then people don't think about things like TPP and how the long-term effects trickles down, for lack of a better term, but it smashes those who are the most vulnerable of.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. And maybe the root of the question is this. I asked it a little disjointedly, but Abigail, I'll turn to you. Is, you know, for progressive politics in particular, where I think those of us who are looking to go into communities like this and say, hey, like, you know, get out, vote for us, blah, 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 we're going to make a difference. I mean, it seems like it's just there's a huge credibility gap at this stage in the game, though, because so many politicians have come in and said they're going to solve the problem and haven't done it. And I mean, you think about Bill Clinton. I was thinking about this yesterday walking down the street. We're going to retrain all the workers in America. There's no one's going to be left behind. And like, if you're living in Milwaukee, you clearly were not retrained. You've clearly been left behind. I mean, it just seems like a big challenge we're facing.
Look, it is a big challenge we're facing, but I don't. You know, the challenge is not, oh, politicians have been making all these promises and not living up to them. The challenges are the challenges of our time, right? People are looking to be involved. They're looking to be engaged, and they want to be involved in politics and in policymaking and what is going on at their communities. So I think really what the challenge is giving people enough opportunities so they can take advantage of that energy, of that enthusiasm, and of that excitement. And that's why the Democratic Party is really uniting in all of our community members, uniting around these economic populist issues that really touch people at the core. Right. So we are talking about debt-free college. We're talking about, you know, expanding Social Security benefits. We are talking about raising minimum wage to $15 an hour. These very like bread and butter issues that touch people where they are in their day-to-day lives and that impact people across the board. It's not just in Milwaukee, right? It's also going to be in Seattle and in Orlando, right? And in Iowa and New Hampshire and all these different places. So I think it's the challenge is not necessarily all of these politicians haven't come through for us. It's, you know, the people are speaking, the people are getting involved, there's evolution happening, and people want to have a say in their government, and they are making their voices heard at the ballot box. I think we're really going to see that this, you know, all these primary elections happening right now and in November. People are coming out, they're getting engaged, and they want to have a say in what's going on, and they're going to.
On the one hand, I hear you, but on the other hand, for example, Democratic primary turnout was down off of 08 this year. I think on local elections, there is a significant number of people who do not vote. So, I mean, in some ways, I agree with you. Like, obviously, there are rising social movements and things like that in the streets where people are saying they want one thing. But it also seems that there is a feeling that people don't trust quote unquote politicians to carry it out. So I mean, I don't know. I'm not trying to like aggressively push back here, but I do think that there's more of an issue there than perhaps you're giving play to.
Sure. Well, I think you make a good point here. And really, I think the question is, are we, you know, when we talk about a voter, right, is this somebody who is literally voting, or is this somebody who can potentially get out and vote, but they are an engaged citizen? Right. And where is that transition happening? People who are attending Bernie Sanders rallies, people who are writing op-eds and they are, you know, attending all these actions and signing petitions to the members of Congress and making phone calls and showing up at these rallies. You know, these are engaged community members and citizens. And one of the big questions and challenges for people who work in this industry is encouraging those people to make their voices now heard at the ballot box. So I think primaries are always difficult, right? It's like who votes in primary elections, who gets involved in these things. But I think that when people are proud, when they're angry, when they are inspired, when they're afraid, when people are feeling these heightened levels of emotion because they're really seeing how much politics does impact their lives, mm-hmm. how much these policies impact their lives, they do make a transition. And that is why we are so focused on a progressive agenda that really impacts people's lives. So mm-hmm. I hear you. I know what you're saying, and I don't necessarily disagree, but it's that transition from community member and activist and citizen to voter that I think we're right in the middle of an exciting time about.
Sure. Well, and Delvon, we got a couple minutes before our next, our first break, but go ahead and get in on this.
I agree with everything Abigail's saying. I totally support a progressive agenda, but the bottom line is that we simply haven't delivered, regardless of what party it is. Whether it's Democrats or Republicans, there's a reason that people at the local levels are all rising up because the system hasn't delivered what they need. We do need a $15 an hour minimum wage. We do all need all those things that Abigail is talking about. But like, Democrats have had free reign in a lot of the cities in this country. We happily simply have not delivered. And it's time for that. They've gotten a mulligan because it looks like they've nominated a dumpster fire on the other side. So we've got to deliver this time around.
And is that why there's a Working Families Party, though, to speak to that question?
Absolutely, because there are a lot of purple Democrats out there who talk the talk but don't walk the walk. And that's we see it as our job to make those people and hold those people accountable. And hopefully this time around we'll be more successful than last.
Well, I also hope so. I mean, certainly, as anyone who listens to this show knows, I probably have not that much hope for that. But I always am very hopeful that the movement of the masses of people in our society can make something happen. And I just wonder, too, Delvon, on a related issue, has this, the context of Milwaukee, Ferguson, Baltimore, has that really in the mind of those of you guys at Working Families perhaps sort of reaffirmed the need to expand what you guys are doing?
No question about it. I think lots of progressives, not necessarily my friend Abigail, but they look at things through an economic lens. There's got to be looked at it intersectionally. We got to look at it with a racial lens, and we got to look at it with an intersectional lens as well. The policies that we're actually advocating for, those disadvantaged members of marginalized communities are the ones who often suffer the most when we the issues that we actually work on.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And we are going to take a break, but we will be back with much, much more from Delvon Michael and Abigail Collazo on progressive politics. This is By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation on what Clinton and the Democrats are going to have to do to keep progressive support, the intersectionality of movements, and the emergence of new leaders on the left side of the spectrum around the country. And we are joined, happy to be joined, in studio by Mr. Delvon Michael, the Working Families DC, from Working Families DC, and by phone, Abigail Collazo, the Electoral Director of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, PCCC. Woo! Lot going on there. But nevertheless, very happy to have you. And, you know, Delvon, you left off on a good question, and I wanted to turn to you, Abigail, on a similar issue around intersectionality. You guys do a lot of not just work around helping people get elected, but I know you also work to help folks, you know, figure out how to run and how to get themselves in the game if they're interested and what they need to do and learn. So I wonder from your perspective, and maybe you guys have already talked about this too, how is PCCC viewing some of these new movements like the Movement for Black Lives? I mean, are you thinking or looking or open to creating partnerships with organizations in that space, the Movement for Black Lives space, who are becoming more interested in getting involved in campaigns?
I think not just looking to, but eager to and excited to, and it's so necessary. You know, we were just heavily involved in an election out in Seattle a couple of weeks ago with Pramila Jayapal, who won her primary by 20 points. She hit one of the top spots. Yeah, it was really exciting. And, you know, during the victory speech, I was on the ground with her, and she said, you know, this huge crowd of people who had worked with her on immigration reform and raising the minimum wage and all the campaigns she'd been a part of. And she said, you know, I'm not a woman on Mondays and an immigrant on Tuesdays and a mother on Wednesdays. Right? Like, intersectionality is critical for us for understanding what's going on in the community and for pushing these policies that impact all of us. You know, and it's so for us, PCCC, and we hope for all of our friends in the progressive movement, this is not even a question anymore. It's not if, but it's when and how, and how much can we coordinate and make sure that all of our movements are interacting, are benefiting from this conversation. So it's not I think, even a question anymore, right? It's absolutely, we have to be cognizant of these issues, and we have to make the most of them, right? Like, mm-hmm. this is how people are. This is a question of identity. For a lot of people, it is very personal. You know, so I think you will find, particularly the women's rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, the economic populist movement, we are all working together to push forward these economic populist issues that impact all of us and all of these identities and movements together.
Mm-hmm. And Delvon, let me say a similar situation to you. I don't know if working families, to what extent you are. Well, I do know a little bit about this. I know that some folks who are in the Movement for Black Lives space are Working Families Party people, because I was at the Movement for Black Lives National Convening with you and four or five other folks from WFP. So that being said, I wonder where the conversations you guys are having about moving forward in this moment with sort of, I think now with the Vision for a Black Lives Policy Platform, I think it's sort of clear that this is here to stay, how that's affecting how you view the work. And then I have a follow-up from that.
Yeah, well, we're just trying to get engaged in a work that we're trying to be as creative as possible. Clearly, we want to elect officials who are going to take on the Black Lives Matter platform, of course, other economic policies. But we're expanding ways of doing things like getting involved in district attorney races, things of that nature. I think, like, oftentimes you talk about who wins as president as being the most important thing, but then after we vote for president, we go home and get stopped by a racist cop who gets prosecuted by a racist DA and then thrown in jail by a racist judge. Looking at expanding a program and actually targeting district attorneys around the country, something similar to what happened in Chicago. So be on the lookout for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a good question. And so my follow-up to that is, I'll certainly turn the same question to you as well, Abigail, is I wonder, and I'll start with you, Delvon, what, seeing this Vision for Black Lives policy platform, I mean, how much do you think progressive groups that are not in this space need to sort of sit with that? I mean, I think everyone now wants a Black Lives Matter merit badge. I'm willing to believe that all of us on this interview are all extraordinarily sincere about that, but I think everyone wants it. So, I mean, now that there's like you couldn't really be more exhaustive list of policy issues. How much do progressive groups who say they support Black Lives Matter really need to sit with that and see, like, do I really support this? I mean, I think we saw some folks in the Jewish community, for instance, who sat with it and were like, whoa, that ain't me. And so how much does that process need to happen?
This is an extremely important question, above and beyond whether they're in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. It's more than just signing on to a letter. It's more than just going to a rally. It's more than just even speaking at a rally. Progressive organizations have to sit down and look at themselves internally. They have to look at their hiring practices, look at all of their institutional history, their institutional mission, and see if it reflects the values that we talk about with Black Lives Matter. Do they really matter? Because it's more than just, most importantly, more immediately, police killing innocent Black men, but it's also, are we hiring folks? Are we giving people an opportunity to actually grow in our institution? Are we giving them positions that have visibility, access to actually help them with strategy and actually paying them a living wage, things of that nature? Because basically, until you've done that, then I would say that you're not in solidarity. You might be in line with them, but certainly not in solidarity. I think I would start with that and give Abigail some room to.
Mm-hmm. So, Abigail, I don't know what you think about sort of the same question there, particularly perhaps in light of what we saw in the Sanders campaign, where, I mean, you know, ultimately he came out with some very good stuff on criminal justice and other things, but obviously had some trouble connecting with Black, quote unquote, Black voters.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100% with everything Devon said. You know, actions speak louder than words, right? So, mm-hmm. yes, we can sign petitions and we can say that we care about these issues and intersectionality and Black Lives Matter and community policing. But at the end of the day, what actions are all of us taking to turn this vision into a reality? And that's on all of us, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about, you know, like, no organization that is working in the progressive space can, I think, even afford to just be a single issue organization anymore. Mm. Now, there are groups that are focusing on particular issues, and that's a comparative advantage we have, right? That's how we're all stronger together, is focusing on, you know, each of us sort of pushing forward particular issues. And for our organization, you know, we're really focusing on building a block of progressive power that is centered around Elizabeth Warren type ideas like debt-free college and taking on Wall Street and expanding Social Security benefits and raising the minimum wage. But none of that can exist in a vacuum. It can't. Mm-hmm. It does not even count for a progressive issue. We talk about particular political candidates and reaching out to different demographics. You know, they need to walk the walk. They need to show that they take into consideration different perspectives that they are. I think Savan really hit the nail on the head when he said giving different communities leadership positions, having them be involved in strategy instead of just talking to different people, right? It's talking with them. So you'll see this now, I think, within the Democratic Party is, as we're not writing anybody off, right? Mm-hmm. It's outreach to all communities and giving them that opportunity to be involved at senior strategic levels. And it is critical. It is necessary. And there's, I don't think, any progressive group in America that can afford to not make that a top priority for their organization.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And slightly shifting gears and sticking with you, Abigail, one other question I have, and I took a look today at the Bernie-crats network. I don't even know if that's official, but it's people who like Bernie Sanders who are running for office. And I was impressed, I have to say, by the number of people at various levels of professionalism who are out there running. But hey, I'm with it. Get out there, do your thing. I'm all for it. But what do you think, seeing like all these people who are running? I think that the R Revolution, the post-Bernie organization, now has almost like 3,000 people hosting house parties for their launch that's coming up. I mean, what do you think, Abigail, are some of the biggest challenges to turning this, I think what is clearly sort of a wave of momentum, into something that's really got staying power and political power, perhaps, maybe is what I'm looking for.
Sure. Well, I think there are two strong elements to this, right? One is at the personal community level. People are looking to host house parties, right? They want to get involved, and it's keeping that momentum up and keeping people engaged and excited about that involvement. You know, are they just excited about our revolution at the launch, you know, when there's still a lot of media attention around it and a lot of excitement? Or are they going to continue to be excited about it and to be engaged and enthusiastic about the work that our revolution is looking to do in the days, months, and years ahead? And one thing that helps with that, right, is seeing results. And this is what we talked about a number of times today, is what are the results? Who's actually getting it done? You know, is it just Bernie Sanders is going to send an email to raise money for a couple of down ballot people? Or is it what I think our revolution is really about and starting to be about, is really turning attention to these down ballot races, to local community efforts to push forward and to promote these economic populist ideas that really put people and communities at the center of how we organize, of how we create policy, of how we interact with one another and with our government officials. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once they start seeing the fruits of their labor, right, and they start seeing that they can put people in office who reflect them and their values and ideals, and they can see results the way that we have with seeing the center of gravity shift within the Democratic Party to, you know, we went from don't cut Social Security to expand Social Security. We went from raise the minimum wage to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Right? So right. Once people see all of this movement and they see the fruits of that, right, that's the sort of thing that continues to motivate and engage people. So I think those are the two pieces to it, right? Like focusing on the people, keeping that momentum going, keeping the volume high on these issues that affect so many of us at all the different intersections of our identities and our lives, and actually seeing results.
No, I hear you. Well, and it's an interesting comment, and I was actually glad you raised the Pramila Jayapal question, because I think obviously we've seen that to a certain degree in Seattle. I mean, really starting with the 15 now, then the Shama Sawant phenomenon, and that clearly, you know, even the mayor, who's like the most pro-corporate dude on earth, is like now presenting everything like it's like, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution or whatever. And I think that just speaks to the fact that obviously the base of people at a local level are shifting. But I wonder too, Delvon, what you think from the working family's perspective, and especially because, you know, you all perhaps have been prior to this trying to do sort of a similar thing, right, is take some of the energy from social movements, from people who are out here who want to make progressive change, and try to get folks running. So what do you see as some of the big challenges to keeping this momentum going, if indeed you even think it should?
Yeah, actually, I think it should. I'm really excited about the opportunity that, you know, our revolution is providing. Now, we had, you know, OFA that kind of fizzled out, but
well, was allowed. You know, hey, you don't have to comment on this, but was 100% allowed. I agree with the great Marshall Gans, man. When he was like, Obama had the greatest army of organizers ever and then did nothing with it. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No worries. I think we should still take some lessons from that army. The reason the Obama campaign was so successful in 2008 is that they went out and told people to organize. Mm-hmm. And when those thousands and thousands of people showed up, they funnel right into a system, right into a plan with people who were waiting arms who knew what to do with them. I think that was severely lacking. And I went to 16 states for Bernie Sanders this time, and I found that not to be the case. But hopefully You know, our revolution will do more helping people actually know what it takes to run for office, know what it takes to actually organize their communities, and then it will actually perpetuate itself. The fact of the matter is we've called this a revolution. We'll know if it's a revolution next year. We have, you know, 500 people running for local office, right? Next time, 2 years from now, having 100 people running for Congress. That's what's going to show whether the long-term effects of what happened this last year was, and I hope that it actually goes on. I know I'll be doing everything I can within my party to make sure that it actually keeps going.
No, of course. And the other issue I wanted you to address just while we're semi on the topic is this issue of money in elections. I know this is a huge issue for you. You're working on it here in Washington, D.C. I mean, obviously, Sanders showed you can raise a lot of money grassroots if people are really motivated. But if I think we're being realistic, you know, we're not all consistently on TV getting talked about by CNN and getting people knowing about us. So, I mean, how important is it to keep this wave going that we tackle this issue of just corporate capture of the elections?
Right, totally. It's important that we capitalize off it right now while it's on everyone's top of everyone's mind. But like you said, it's definitely going to fizzle out. Like, he won't be on TV every 3 days. He won't be on the news every morning. People will probably slow down with their contributions. But I think there's enough dedicated activists out there, people who are looking for something to belong to, that can keep it going and make it effective. He fit right into the void where I think my experience was that a lot of people, a lot of remnants of Occupy and other social movements found this place at this one time, came together and did something that was pretty special. They almost took it to the top of the mountain, but not quite. And I think that 4 years from now, they'll have a, you know, I won't even go there. Let me stop.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, obviously, it was very significant. But I wonder, too, Abigail, from your perspective, I mean, how critical is it that, and maybe we could take it one step beyond just money and politics, also just in general, electoral reform and getting, you know, different types of ranked choice, whatever it may be. I mean, I know some people, it's like they fetishize it. If you don't have this, you can't do anything. So how important is it to you in pushing a progressive change agenda to really, you know, sort of tackle that issue?
But look, at the end of the day, you know, money and politics is something that impacts all of the different issues that we are working on, right? If people can just roll in and buy an election, right, they can push forward whatever kind of corporate tactics they want, whatever kind of, you know, special interest favors that they want and often do. And I think that is one reason why you see in so many races, so many grassroots community candidates who are running, you know, not these, you know, inspiring Bernie Sanders type campaigns where they are raising millions, millions of dollars online, but they're still running on the same values. And they're still talking a lot about Citizens United and a lot about money and politics. And, you know, you look at somebody like Susanna Randolph, who's running in Florida's 9th. I'm actually on the ground with her campaign right now here in Orlando. And, you know, some of her opponents are, you know, who have A ratings from the NRA or who are pharmaceutical lobbyists and who, you know, are clearly supporting by the special interests. We've got Susanna, who's a community organizer. She's been working in a community at that level on women's health issues, on expanding Social Security benefits, you know, raising minimum wages we talked about. So, you know, I hear you on sort of not everyone's on CNN being able to talk about these issues. But I'm telling you, in all the campaigns that I have traveled to, and a lot of them are congressional and down ballot across the country, candidates are talking not just about the need to overturn Citizens United, you know, and to get rid of sort of this, you know, buying influence in Congress concept, but you're transferring that power to the people, and they're talking about it at the local level and what it means in terms of who they stand up for, who they're going to Congress and, or to state capitals or wherever to represent, and what their actual values are. So even at the local level, people are talking about this issue, and it is, I think, both broader and deeper and more local than just, you know, Citizens United in general.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's a great point. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there for the time being. But special thanks to all of our guests on this segment. We are going to take a break. We will be back with some more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about a whole number of intersections between electoral politics, the movement for Black Lives, and some foreign policy, and we are joined for this conversation by Mr. Ben Norton, who is a journalist at Salon.com. Ben, thank you so much for joining the show.
I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And you know, so one of the places I want to start is, you know, interestingly, we're sort of seeing in the news this week discussion about how there may be some senators attempting to block the weapons to Saudi Arabia. And I thought about that in an interesting way. Is in the way it plays out in domestic politics in this campaign, you've got Hillary Clinton on the one hand saying, well, Black Lives Matter. On the other hand, being super complicit with, you know, the Saudi regime, wars in Syria, the most full-throated support for Israel. So, I mean, it just makes me wonder, is it really possible for there to be any sort of convergence between sort of the Hillary Clinton forces in the Democratic Party and some of these new social movements we see rising in the streets?
Well, I think in foreign policy, there really is no hope. I mean, and I hate to sound really pessimistic, but Clinton really is one of the most hawkish people in the U.S. government, even compared to the Republicans. In fact, you know, I've mentioned a lot in different pieces that the New York Times endorsed Clinton for president, but it also admitted in a very long piece about her hawkishness that she is more hawkish than the Republicans. The New York Times actually, you know, acknowledged this in a very long form piece. So, you know, I think when we're looking at her foreign policy, it's in many ways, you know, kind of off of planet Earth. And, you know, you can look at Saudi Arabia, you can look at Israel, you can look at Syria and Libya, you know, in all of which she has, you know, supported extremely hawkish policies. In Saudi Arabia, I mean, there's been a brutal war going on since March of 2015. And, you know, this past week, there have been at least four bombings of civilian areas that killed more than 50 Yemenis, including a house, a school, a hospital, etc. And, you know, we can talk about Israel and its bombing of Gaza and the fact that Clinton in November wrote an op-ed or an open letter, rather, in the Jewish Daily Forward saying that she would invite Netanyahu to the White House in her first month in office, and expressing staunch support. So I think, you know, I think the left and social movements absolutely need to pressure Hillary Clinton because, you know, otherwise she won't budge at all. But I don't think that there's a way for her party essentially to converge with those movements because they're essentially at odds.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's a good point. And it also makes me think of another issue, which is, you know, we're talking about human rights violations. Obviously, the U.S. government always saying, and Hillary Clinton certainly when she was Secretary of State, well, we're for human rights, we're for human rights, we're for human rights. But the United Nations recently came out with a report, if I'm not mistaken, that actually criticized a lot of what's going on in America, policing-wise and otherwise, as having at least some human rights connotations. Your analysis there.
Well, yes, you're right. It was not the UN as you know, the entire institution. It was a UN special rapporteur. So he's an expert that works with the UN on particular rights. And this is Maina Kiai. He's a Kenyan lawyer and human rights activist who's currently serving as the UN special rapporteur on the rights of peaceful assembly and freedom of association. Mm. So he went on a 17-day trip to the US in July. He went to the RNC and the DNC. He looked at the protests. He interviewed scores of activists and human rights officials and government officials. And then he wrote about a 6,500-word summary of his experience, which he's eventually going to expand into a very detailed report that he gives to the UN. And in the summary of his report, the UN expert excoriated the police state in the U.S., as he essentially characterized it. I mean, he discussed the impact of police in particular on Black Americans, which he, you know, said is incredibly repressive. He talked about how, you know, Black Americans who are involved in activism and political work are often heavily targeted. Members of the Movement for Black Lives have been targeted by police. He said police have been infringing on the freedom of association and freedom of expression by arresting protesters or intimidating protesters. He also spoke about the war on drugs and broken windows policing, both of which he characterized as racist programs. He spoke of systemic racism against Black Americans. I mean, it really is an aggressive and firm condemnation of U.S. policing and racism in the U.S., and it was perhaps unsurprisingly largely ignored by the U.S. media. There were a few news outlets that mentioned it, but they were mostly alternative news outlets. They weren't like the big newspapers like the New York Times and Washington Post.
Well, I wonder, why do you think that is? Because both of those newspapers have, you know, sort of prided themselves on their coverage of these issues, quote unquote, Black Lives Matter, police violence. Why do you think that they didn't cover something of this, I would say, significant magnitude?
Well, I do agree with you. I think they have done some good coverage. It's been, you know, somewhat more balanced in the sense that, you know, they'll often quote police chiefs, et cetera. But I mean, it certainly has been supportive of people's civil rights. But I also think in general that many of the things that the UN does are often ignored by the US media. And I think the US media is very narcissistic in the way that the country is. You know, the media reflects this kind of American exceptionalist mentality that says, well, what's happening in the US is important, but not necessarily what's happening elsewhere unless we're involved in it. And I mean, to be clear, the UN certainly isn't, you know, an anti-US institution by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, it's usually the opposite. But when it comes to these kinds of reports, you know, these are frequent. For instance, this week, there's also going to be a UN expert report on the war crimes committed in Yemen. And I've been following this closely. And these kinds of things also frequently aren't reported on. So, I mean, to be fair, the UN is an enormous institution and it has many different experts like this rapporteur who are focusing on particular areas. But I also think, you know, the US media does frequently tend to emphasize what US officials are saying and not necessarily what UN experts are saying. It does tend to give voice and a platform to, you know, people who are inside the US and not necessarily human rights activists from Kenya who visit the US and speak from a more impartial perspective. And I think those perspectives are the ones that are more important. And I think journalists should focus on those, but they frequently don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let me also ask you this question. I mean, I wonder if the major, perhaps, impact of this report, I don't know if I could call it that, is, or let me back up. You know, sort of historically, when we look at the civil rights movement, we see how important the context of the Cold War was in terms of pushing American politicians to feel like they were, you know, quote unquote, doing something on civil rights to avoid embarrassment. I mean, could this report sort of play a similar role in American politics vis-a-vis sort of whatever the people think about police issues in America per se? It starts to get too hot for them and too complicated because people around the world look at it as such a black mark on America.
I think that's certainly part of it, absolutely. And I agree overall with that analysis. And just as a caveat or as an aside really quickly, I think it's important to recognize that throughout the Cold War, the CIA was funding many progressive groups. Steinem, the famous feminist, Gloria Steinem famously, you know, said in an interview that she had been working with the CIA and she characterized it as a progressive institution. And they sponsored her to go to an anti-communist conference. And she was a socialist, you know, she was a democratic socialist and she was, you know, sponsored by the CIA to go to this anti-communist conference. So certainly I think you are touching something there. You know, to be honest, there are parts of the deep state in the US government that are critical of things like police brutality. And I mean, I don't think it's, I think it is accurate to say that there are elements of the US which do ostensibly support democracy and things like that. But you know, in foreign policy, it's very different. Usually in foreign policy, we're supporting autocracy and tyranny throughout the world. But domestically, I think there are elements of the government that do want things to look better. And I don't think that, you know, the entire deep state is necessarily just like we need to destroy these black lives. But, you know, this is a reflection of a long 400-year process that, you know, the U.S. kind of represents even before it was founded. There's always been a devaluation of black life. There's always been a subjugation of black people and exploitation of their labor from the very beginning. And it goes back and forth. And, you know, I think that we are seeing some breakthroughs and eventually, of course, the government is going to make some concessions. But I think that's also why it's important that you have this external pressure because, you know, at the end of the day, as you mentioned, you know, this legacy of extreme racism, which we still see today, is one of the biggest, you know, factors that demonstrates how American exceptionalism is false. It's one of the biggest stains in U.S. history. And the U.S. can always claim, oh, you know, we're a democratic country. We're the oldest democracy. And that technically on paper is true, but it's a democracy in which, you know, the 13% of the population who who are black weren't allowed to vote essentially until 1965. And, you know, women weren't allowed to vote until 1920. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with your analysis. And I think that there's always this constant internal struggle going on within the government with some people who actually do support some progressive reforms, at least domestically. Although, as I stressed earlier, I mean, with foreign policy, there often isn't that kind of struggle. I mean, that's why if you look at the Democratic and Republican parties, they might have internal issues domestically that are, you know, at odds with each other. But oftentimes in international affairs and foreign policy, they're identical.
Mm-hmm. Well, and while we're talking on the issue of politics, too, you know, I wanted to circle back a little bit. You know, you mentioned the concept of the deep state or the existence of it. And, you know, it's something that many people know about. But for folks who don't know, give us just some sort of brief overview about what is the deep state.
Well, when you think about a government, especially something like the U.S. government, which is enormous, it's probably one of the biggest governments in the world, you know, not every single official in that government is elected. And oftentimes you have officials who are elected who appoint hundreds or even thousands. I mean, the president often appoints thousands of different people. And if you look at different administrations, oftentimes many of these figures in the government, you know, occupy the same role in different administrations. You know, you can see this in the NSA and the CIA and the FBI and these other institutions. And, you know, these are the kind of constant figures that represent what you call the deep state, you know, the elements of the government that don't change from administration to administration. And, you know, Henry Kissinger is a great example of someone who is really part of the deep state. You know, Kissinger has been around since the Nixon days. You know, he played a leading role in expanding the war in Vietnam and many other conflicts. And he's widely identified throughout the world as a war criminal. But he's also advised every single administration since Nixon. Mm. You know, he's been omnipresent. And Clinton constantly invokes his name. And recently she's been seeking a public endorsement. So these kinds of figures really do reflect a kind of a basis, a kind of political basis that doesn't really change. What, you know, people like Bernie Sanders recently and his supporters have been calling the establishment, you know, or the status quo. And that's what the deep state is. And oftentimes we don't talk much about the deep state, but it's always there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's certainly relevant, especially from the point of view of how people, you know, relate or don't relate to the whole issue of democracy or where it should bend. But in a way, that was briefly an aside, because the other thing I wanted to circle back around and touch on, too, and this is also sort of related to the interplay between foreign policy and domestic policy, is this issue of the criticism by a number of Jewish organizations. I mean, I hate to even say it like that, as if they represent all Jews, that criticizing the movement for Black Lives.
Zionist organizations.
Exactly. Which, unfortunately, groups that used to care about more than that seem to only care about. So, I mean, I wonder how that struck you, the overall situation with this just, I thought, pretty intense criticism of the movement for Black Lives for raising critiques of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I really want to applaud the Movement for Black Lives platform. I think it's an amazing document. I'm just saying that as a person, not necessarily in my capacity as a journalist. I mean, I think it's really remarkable. And as a reporter, I interviewed two of the co-authors of the platform. And one of them, Rachel Gilmer, who's an activist with Dream Defenders and who wrote the bulk of the Israel-Palestine position, really stressed to me when I was interviewing her that, you know, the Movement for Black Lives wanted to express international solidarity because, you know, Black Americans are part of a international diaspora. But even more than that, you know, the Black Liberation Movement has always been inextricably tied to international liberation movements. And she stressed that Palestinian liberation is really at the core of that today. You know, it's the global anti-imperialist movements and liberation movements really, in many ways today, kind of, I don't want to say revolve around, but are really influenced by the Palestinian liberation movement because it's gaining so much traction and it's becoming such a big deal. And, you know, this is an issue that's certainly not new. It's been going on since 1947 and before, but with the BDS movement taking off, with, you know, this being debated in the democratic debates, which is unheard of historically, the Movement for Black Lives really wanted to affirm solidarity with Palestinians. And what's interesting about the platform is it draws parallels between not just apartheid South Africa, but through, you know, the forms of apartheid and racial segregation that Black Americans endure in the U.S. under Jim Crow and other forms of institutional racism. So the fact that all these Zionist groups are opposing this, I think, is very, you know, very worrying. But to be clear, I mean, of course, the Jewish community in the U.S. is very divided, but not all of the Jewish community oppose all these, you know, Jewish civil society groups oppose the platform. Mm-hmm. Jewish Voice for Peace, and particularly the Jews of Color Caucus of Jewish Voice for Peace, released statements endorsing the Movement for Black Lives platform. So there is this kind of internal struggle going on within these Jewish civil society groups. And we should also just, you know, mention that many Jewish Americans are very progressive, and oftentimes their political views aren't reflected by these groups. So yeah, I think, you know, there is definitely a segment of these Zionist groups that oppose Palestinian solidarity, but oftentimes, you know, they may say that they've supported civil rights, but, you know, they haven't really held up their side of the deal. And, you know, there are groups like the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which claims to be a civil rights group, and ostensibly, historically, it previously was, but it's really drifted rightward in the past decades. In 2003, it endorsed the Iraq War. So yeah, these groups may claim that, you know, we stand with Black Lives, but if they're not the ones, you know, who are endorsing the Movement for Black Lives platform and standing solidarity with these protesters, then I think their opinion's ultimately irrelevant. Really, the only big Jewish American group, really big, I mean, they're small ones, of course, I'm not trying to ignore them, but the really big group, national group that endorsed the Movement for Black Lives platform is Jewish Voice for Peace, which is also the fastest growing Jewish American group. Mm. So I think these old groups are really out of touch. And it's not surprising that their politics aren't in line with what many young Americans and progressive Americans are calling for.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And with that, we are going to be out of time for the show today. But special thanks to Ben Norton from Salon.com for joining the show. And this was By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.